Hello and welcome to the TotCast Pod Show, the number one show on the internet, and the new breed of airbender. I'm Lanny, and I'm joined this week by your favorite mover star, Kaiser Neko.
I would have gone with footage bender, but I'll go with mover star.
Well, if they may, you know what? When we come back for the live action Avatar adaptation of Netflix, I'll keep that one in mind.
Oh boy.
So Legend of Korra dropped, currently sitting, I think, at like number 6 on their trending list. It dipped a lot quicker than the last Airbender, but there's reasons for that. I'm surprised that putting Korra on there didn't bump Last Airbender back up onto the list, honestly.
You know what? Yeah, that's a good point. I can see a lot of people being like, oh, Korra's up. Now I'm going to watch them both. I mean, maybe that did happen, but...
Yeah, it probably did. There are probably people that went back and watched through Avatar, like, you know, just, oh, there's two of these shows? Like, maybe they didn't get it the first time. It's like, oh, okay, hold on, maybe I should watch through these. So it probably got a bump. Kind of like anybody who's familiar with YouTube, whenever you upload something that's, like, part of a similar series, everything before it gets a bump. So I'm sure that, you know, while it might not have been as big, it was there. But this is easily one of the more controversial shows that Nickelodeon has put out. In terms of how it divided the fan base, a lot of people look at it like, this ruined Avatar. I hate what they did to all the characters. I would have rather just watched Adventures of Grown-Up Aang and Sokka and all them.
Let me put it out there. I did not want Adventures of Grown-Up Aang and all them. I mean, if we'd gotten like maybe an episode or some stuff on that, that would have been neat. But I definitely
kind of did.
Yeah. Well, we kind of did. We got a little bit of the whole Yakon stuff, which we'll get into. But like, honestly, I did not need an entire series about Grown-Up Aang and friends. We had their stories and they were great and I'm glad. But yeah, no thanks.
Which is part of kind of the magic of, like, this universe that they created with Avatar. They have this cycle where, okay, every generation, there's a new one. So you get to have this, like, awesome passage of time. You get introduced to a whole bunch of new characters. And they have their own little journeys that they have to deal with. I think it is a brilliant concept for an amazing universe that, like, is full. Like, jam-packed with possibilities that I don't think Nickelodeon even wanted to come close to trying to, you know, tap into the potential of that. Like, they literally could have had, like, a Harry Potter or a Star Wars on their hands with this.
Yeah, that's sort of an interesting point. And I think that's really, I think that is encapsulated by the fact that when Korra came back, they were like, no, we just want the one season. And then Bright was like, okay, one season. And then...
Yeah.
Yeah, by the way, for anybody who doesn't know, which, if you're a fan of Korra but aren't familiar with its background, Korra was only going to be one season originally. It kind of shows. Oh, it very much shows. But with the ending of season one not setting up anything for this for the seasons after, you can really tell that, no, this was supposed to just be a mini-series. And then Nickelodeon was like, no, we want 3 more seasons. And then they said, oh, and by the way, not only do we want 3 more seasons, but they're all going to be the same length as the first one, and you can't have a continuous story between them. They all have to be their own isolated seasons telling one overarching story.
That was the question I was going to have there, because unlike The Last Airbender, which had one drawn-out continuous plot that it followed, every single season, like, it felt like Nickelodeon was renewing as they went along. Because... Mm-hmm. And that's part of the, on one hand, problem of Korra, but there's also, like, I guess a little bit of silver lining to that, in that, you know what, if you do just want to stop somewhere, you just can.
Yeah, at the end
unfortunately,
of...
Unfortunately, you don't want to stop at the end of season three. Yeah, what I was about to say is, unfortunately, season two is kind of in the middle of that, so nobody blames you if you want to stop there, but the... Okay, how would you rank the seasons of Korra? Because I know how, like, my tier list of the Korra seasons. Oh. Obviously, like, put it out of the way, season 2 is at the bottom, I'm going to assume.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
But like, how would you rank them?
For me personally, it's 3, 1, 4, 2.
I agree. 3 and 1 are kind of like toss-upable in my mind, but yeah. 3 has one of the most compelling villains and easily some of the best fight choreography.
Yeah, because it's tough, because I'll say that 1 has a better overall story than 3 does, partially yes. because I feel like it's a cohesive whole and there aren't a
it
bunch
was more,
of...
It was more coherent and they were able to plan it out.
Yeah, but 3 has these amazing... like dramatic moments, such I'm sorry, the stuff with the Beifong family is actually really good, and the action scenes are the best that the show has ever had. Season 3 has the best action scenes in all of Avatar or Korra, and it's amazing. But you're not wrong in that. I could on a different day, it could have been 1, 3, 4, 2.
Yeah, I put a caveat on the best fights because there is one fight that really sticks out to me. And by the way, spoilers for Korra.
Oh, just yeah, yeah.
Straight
spoilers.
Up spoilers. Yeah. This show's been out for, what, like 5, 6 years, 7 years now? Something like that. It's been out on Netflix for a couple of weeks now. If you haven't seen it yet, please, like, you know, by all means, treat yourself. It's not as good as The Last Airbender overall. I do think it has some pretty high peaks, but its valleys lie way lower.
Yes. And that's... I was thinking the other day, I was like, wow, this is a lot like Dragon Ball Super, where its peaks are incredibly high, and it could be incredibly well animated, but then it does things that just kind of really make me not like the show.
It's not like they introduced anything like Metachlorians. Well, I mean, I guess they kind of did.
I disagree. Oh, okay. Let's go.
We'll get to that. Yeah. I did want to point out my one caveat. I think one of the best fight sequences, like animated out in the show, is Korra versus Kuvira, their first duel.
Oh, that fight is brutal too.
Yeah, it just really shows that they put a lot of effort into, okay, what does like earthbending in combat look like? Because she's doing these low leg sweeps and like the ground's moving towards her. And then when Korra like jumps over that, she does like a swift roundhouse kick. And you can see her pick up a rock from the dirt with her foot as she's doing it. And it goes flying. It's so cool. Like just the little details in a lot of this choreography. It's no wonder that this show was nominated for so many daytime Emmys for its animation.
Yeah. I'm going to be mean to this show during this, by the way. I want y'all to know. I'm going to be as fair as I possibly can. I'm not going to be a screamy, whiny bitch. But man, I have some problems with the show, and I'm not going to treat it nicely.
I'm probably not going to disagree with a lot of the things you disliked about it, but overall, I think I'm more positive on Korra.
Well, I was also
going
to say, I'm never going to get down on its art and animation, though. And its fights and its music. Like, in terms of visuals and audio, the show, I've got almost zero complaints. I think there were some parts where the music could have been better, and obviously season 2 splits between Studio Pierrot and Studio Mir. But otherwise, this is a beautiful show made by people who are very passionate about it, and I don't want to disqualify all that passion that went into the show, because you can tell how much actually went into making Korra happen.
There are some points where they're trying to blend the CGI with the hand animation, though, where it starts to look just a little Berserk 2016. Like, just a bit. Like, when there are a lot of people in the background and they don't want to hand animate all the people doing stuff, it gets a little clunky. But you know what? When the animation is actually, like, on point and it's, like, you know, the focal point of what's happening, yeah, it is beautiful. But, you know, let's start at the beginning. What were your thoughts when you first heard that Avatar was getting another series?
Actually, I remember being really excited about this because when they were talking about, like, oh, yeah, it's going to be a series all about a female Avatar. And I hated the name at first, though. I was like, Korra? Sounds like coral. This is dumb. Of course, I got over that. But yeah, the moment I saw the first promotional art, and it was Korra standing next to Oh, gosh, I forget the name of the dog. The polar bear dog.
Naga?
Naga. Standing next to Naga, looking out of Republic City. And I remember, like, I was like, is that a woman? Because, you know, Korra cuts a very masculine frame from the back.
Yes, immediately apparent is the fact that this isn't a story about, you know, like the same sort of coming of age tale that Aang had from boyhood to slightly older boyhood. This is this is somebody who is already, you know,
in their
kind
later
of in
teens.
Their young yeah in their young adulthood already.
Yeah, and which it was actually really interesting to me. And they also said, like, this is going to be a darker, more mature story. So I was already incredibly excited. And then we got, you know, the first scene that they showed online was the chase between her and the metal-bending police officers. And I was instantly about it. I couldn't believe how good the show looked, sounded, felt. The fact that they were going for this 1920s, you know, like Chinatown feel, I wanted this show more than anything in the world when they showed that.
I loved as soon as I saw that scene, I'm like, hell yeah. In fact, I think you were the one that linked it to me, just like to kind of show me it.
Yeah, that sounds right.
And at that time, I hadn't seen all of The Last Airbender. I knew it from, like, beginning to end, but I hadn't been able, like, you know, the trappings of network television, I hadn't been able to catch every single episode by that point. But I instantly fell in love with the fact that they went from this old sort of, like, semi-feudalistic era to the roaring 20s within a generation, which kind of makes sense with how they were showing, like, the progression of technology moving along.
Yeah, they were pretty... They already had fucking steam jet skis, which I got...
Yeah, like, they were primed and ready for, like, that jump into the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah.
And then they leapt past that within Aang's lifetime, I guess. And... So you have this, like, beautiful little roaring 20s setting, lots of, like, hot jazz stings in the musical chords, like, but it's still mixed in with that old sort of, I don't know what you'd call it other than sort of Eastern, like, yeah. In, like, musical cuts.
Yeah, they still used a lot of, what they did was they used a lot of Eastern instruments to also supplement the jazz stylings that they were going for, which was really cool. That was a really interesting idea. Mm-hmm. The mixture works. I will actually say this. With the exception of a couple of tracks from Avatar, generally the music in Korra is better. Like, I fully believe the music from Korra is better than most of the music from Avatar The Last Airbender. Not all, but definitely most.
I don't disagree that it's definitely something that I could, like, drive around in my car listening to, whereas almost all the music from Avatar The Last Airbender is something that I could maybe sit around and meditate to, which speaks more to the tones that the shows kind of give off, yeah. I think, and, like, the like what they're going for. But I was instantly drawn into the world. As soon as, like, the episode started coming out, I really liked it. Like, I love the world of season one, like the city of Republic City, the fact that Toph literally invented the police force and taught them all how to metal bend, just being like, hey assholes, you're gonna do this now. This is how you apprehend people. They can't fight it, they'll deal.
I won't lie. So the first season introduces a lot of things that are very that really kind of upset the status quo of Avatar The Last Airbender, including, hey, so lightning benders, they're actually way more common nowadays, which some people were actually really frustrated with, but I actually was on board with that because of the idea of back when the Fire Nation was ruling everything, much like a fascist dictatorship does, it actually suppressed the skills of the lower class. You don't want people being strong enough to overthrow their own government, so you keep them weak, you keep them uneducated, you keep them in line. And so that was really interesting, where, oh yeah, no, they're gone, and now this information is open to everybody. So yeah, I wasn't surprised that there's a bunch of lightning benders nowadays. That's fine.
It also makes sense from the perspective of like how education seems to grow throughout, because you knew more from on a basic level, maybe not on a life skill level, but you knew more on a scientific level graduating from high school or, you know, middle school than your great grandparents would have learned by, you know, going through all of the years of schooling that they possibly could have.
Yep.
It's just how the generations go and how we kind of hold on to intelligence and decide what we're going to teach the next generation. If lightning bending turns out to be a very useful skill for the economy, guess what's going to be taught a lot more to firebenders?
Yep. And this is where, like, there's a lot of really fascinating things going on just through, without saying a damn thing in the actual story itself, just visual storytelling, the environment, world building. And it's so interesting because with some of the things it doesn't say, there are a lot of things that it says and doesn't represent, which I think, you know, we'll get into that with Amon. I also want to say the one thing about the season that going back and rewatching the show, I still didn't like, which was the fucking pro bending. I'm sorry, I did not like the pro bending stuff. It actively just kind of made me tune out.
You can tell that a lot of people didn't, because they dropped it in season two almost instantly.
Yeah.
I personally kind of liked it. I like it when you give me a little fictional sport that's kind of cool. It's like, it had a neat concept, and it was very easy to learn the rules. Like, by the time you finish watching the second or third match of it, you kind of get the point of it. And, yeah. I thought it was ultimately kind of harmless, and it made sense for the world to have something like that.
And the major thing is that it does ultimately play into the story in an interesting way. And that was the thing. That was the only reason I valued it, was when Tano shows up. When Tano shows up and he's cheating and getting away with it, very obviously it helps to make a point, which I appreciated that. But you have all these episodes that first are a fictitious sport. And I'm sorry, fictitious sports are not that interesting to watch for someone like me, because all I can think is like, well, I mean, scripted stuff already, like for stuff like this, is always kind of up in the air. But also, it took bending and really broke it down to kickboxing with bending. And I was like, ooh, okay, one of the cool parts about bending is how it uses different types of martial arts and implements that in the choreography. And here it's like, no, just, you know, bob and weave and punch, and then you do it better. And it's like, okay, I guess. I don't know. I was not about the pro bending myself, but luckily it does tie into the story, so at least it serves a narrative purpose that I appreciated.
It's, yeah, the thing you're going into there, the fact that like everybody had the same form and function, it makes sense that they have that, though, because if you look at it from the perspective of like a professional sport, like let's say MMA. Which, honestly, pro-bending MMA, which we actually get kind of a little bit of a taste of.
That was the original idea with pro-bending, by the way, before they made it with the whole point system.
Bending cage fighting.
Yeah.
But the point is, as if you want to do something effectively, in this case, it's, you know, hit your opponents and knock them off the edge from a distance, you're going to develop a particular type of form and function that is going to be able to combat all of the other forms and, you know, allow you to use your movement to kind of like, you know, feint, juke, and move. And boxing is a very good example of how that would exist in a proper format. So to me, when they're all using kind of the same stance and doing the same moves, which they aren't really, like the earthbender does have different like attack patterns from the waterbender, which has a different one from the firebender.
Yeah.
If you look at it closely.
I mean, no, they're not all the same. Yeah, go ahead.
But it makes sense that they would all kind of have, like, adopted the same style in that, because it turns out that that's what's most effective. Like, modern MMA these days, it's all kind of the same blended martial art, whereas UFC and shows like it started off with people having studied very different martial arts and going against each other, which was the idea of that. Like, you know, let's see which martial art is better. It all sort of coalesced into what is commonly known as MMA now. So the form just kind of changes as time goes on with that type of sport.
Mm-hmm.
We have spent significantly longer talking about pro bending than I expected.
Yeah. So, okay, I want to talk about... Actually... you know what? I'm going to do something that's going to be completely opposite of the last two shows we talked about, one being Avatar and the other one Harley. I want to talk about Korra as a character in the first season. because this is this, like, we can talk about Amon all fucking day, but I think Korra is a character that I actually really wanted to love when the show started.
And the show, I noticed you use the word wanted.
Because the show makes it really hard.
Sometimes it does. Sometimes it does.
Yeah. So in the first couple of episodes, she kind of goes back and forth between being this girl who knows what her purpose is and wants to fulfill that purpose, but because of her limited exposure to the world, does not understand how everything works, much less her actual self. Like, she has an idea of who she is supposed to be in that first season, but she doesn't actually know. This is the first time she's been out on her own after she's been locked away for so long. And unfortunately, because of the way the writers decided to portray her in that first season, she doesn't come off as this likable but flawed person. She just comes off as a brat. As a very, not selfish, but like pushy, ignorant brat. Which I didn't want to be the case. Like, I still loved certain scenes with her. She's this amazingly designed character. It's just the writing fails her. And oh my god, the stuff with Mako is awful. Oh my god.
Mako is honestly one of my least favorite parts of the series. But I actually disagree with you. Like, not in terms of like how she is portrayed, because yeah, she does come across as a little bit bratty, a little bit pushy, and a little bit assertive. But when you're introduced to her, even as a baby, like, you know, as a toddler walking in, I'm the Avatar, you gotta deal with it. It already sets up that she's, you know, hot-headed, she's kind of like in your face about this. And the fact that they had her locked away until she's, I don't know how old she's supposed to be 16. When this starts. 16. Yeah. The fact that they had her locked away in this White Lotus facility, just teaching her Avatar stuff, teaching her bending. Obviously, nobody touching on the spiritual side that often, except for Tenzin, who could, like, maybe stop in every once in a while when he's not trying to repopulate the airbending nation.
Doing a great job of it. Good lord, man.
Yeah, dear God, that poor woman.
That man's dick is crazy. It just won't stop.
Like the exit of a Chuck E. Cheese. Anyway, it makes, like, I think from a narrative point of view, it's brilliant that you had her be in this position, because she gets to be the focal point for everybody else who was so used to the world around them, like, you know, used to the world of The Last Airbender, that when you get introduced to this huge time skip and all, like, the new technology, it's all as much a shock to her as it is to you.
Yeah, that's a good point. I like that.
Yeah, so she's experiencing all this new stuff as you're trying to get caught up on it, because she's aware of the past. She grew up, like, you know, Katara was one of the people that raised her, so she knows everything that we know, plus probably a little bit more about, you know, what happened afterwards, but honestly, that doesn't really matter. So you get introduced to the concepts as she gets introduced to them, and like parts of the audience, she's kind of frustrated that she doesn't know what's going on. And she doesn't have that sort of level of spirituality and, you know, insight that Aang had, being as he was raised as a monk by all the monks.
Yeah.
And so she's, you know, abrasive. She's very confident in her abilities because she mastered literally every other element except airbending by this point. By her words, with very little effort. Like, she was kind of a natural when it came to learning all these other forms. And so when she starts, you know, facing actual opposition, like, you're not supposed to be here. You know, why aren't you learning this faster? She gets frustrated and upset that, you know, she's not living up to what she's supposed to be, which is why leading over to Amon, he's such a good foil in the first season.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's, you know, he's a much better version of the anti-Avatar than season 2 represents.
Right. He,
like, you know, representing this message to the common folk, but, like, you know, you don't need bending to be special. In fact, you know, watch this. I can teach you how to beat any bender in one-on-one combat as long as you have, like, some tools at your disposal and you follow my, like, self-defense classes. And then he kind of shows himself to be this mystic like person when he starts taking people's bending away. And he starts small, you know, with like little crime lords that are, you know, admittedly really good benders, but he keeps like going up and up until he takes out the winners of the pro bending circle. And then he's up against the Avatar. And, you know, you actually feel him as a threat. And so does Korra, who is finally coming to terms with the fact that she doesn't know everything. She's not strong enough. And it's that humbling moment after after the duel on, well, quote unquote, duel on like Avatar Aang Island, at the statue, where she really kind of changes. And that's where she starts to kind of become the Korra that she is for the rest of the series.
Yeah, actually, that scene at the Aang statue is one of the scariest, darkest scenes in the entire show. Just because it is a moment where it's like, yeah, no, not only is she out of her depth here, but she put herself in a situation where she could have honestly either died or kind of, for the sake of the world, worse.
And even more so, she was kind of peer pressured into it.
Yeah, by a character who in the first season I actually found quite interesting, Tarlok.
Yeah.
Tarlok, It's really interesting because between Aman and Tarlok, Tarlok is actually somewhat more of an interesting character for me, even if he's not as cool as Aman is.
He's like, also significantly more evil.
Yes. Generally, yes. But Tarlok, voiced by the fish from American Dad, is a really, really fascinating character because his entire motive, as he says, he's kind of like the opposite of Aman. They both took these different ways that were shaped by early events in their childhoods. That's really cool. There's a lot about it's Tarlok is Klaus. Yes, Tarlok is Klaus. There's a lot that goes on with a lot of people talk about Aman's past and Tarlok's past, and a lot of them, a lot of people really do not like the explanation for Aman. I actually really like the explanation for Aman. The problem is that needed to be the start of a story for him, not the whole thing. Because, and I want to finally touch on this, the plot of season one is a good idea, but the way they tell it sucks. Because they keep talking about benders are oppressing non-benders, they are the enemy, but there's very rarely any decent examples throughout that show that there is true inequality in the city. And Aman just kind of comes off as, you know, like a person who is trying to take advantage of
people who feel powerless. He's literally being a demagogue.
And that could have been interesting, but they never really go one way, either. Like, they never go enough in either direction with that. Because the idea that suddenly when it's revealed that, oh no, he's also a bender, if these people truly felt the way that they were supposed to, if they truly felt like they were being taken advantage of, they probably wouldn't have actually cared all that much. Because Aman was still doing good. That probably wouldn't have actually changed their perspective. But the moment they find out he's a bender, oh, he's one of them, we can't trust this movement anymore. It came off as really kind of, oh, well, I guess that just solves that problem.
Admittedly, it is very odd that after season one, you see no signs of the Equalist movement at all.
Yeah, no, it's gone entirely, which is another problem. Again, the series really suffers from being as segmented as it is. Because you have the other direction of like, well, they want you to think that Aman has a point. The show actively wants you to think, hey, maybe Aman has a point. But no. At no point do you feel like Aman really truly has a point, because the only person who's actually doing anything wrong is Tarlok. And it's so cartoonishly over the top that, yeah, some kids might kind of catch the overall message. But if you look at it with an empirical eye, it just kind of comes off as trite.
A little bit, yeah. Because, it's very, you know, timely would be a good word for it, but like the way they showed, like, as soon as Lin Beifong stepped down as the chief, and I want to get into Lin because I think she is an awesome character.
Lynn is one of the best characters in the entire... Lynn is one of the best characters in the fucking show.
She really is. But she eventually, like, you know, after a whole bunch of the shit goes down, a bunch of, like, equalist, you know, attacks are successful, she eventually steps down as the chief of police. And that's where Tarlok starts kind of, like, you know, putting his own people in power and making moves that... for a while, actually, I thought he and Amon were working together. Especially after the reveal. Because he was making all these moves that would make these non-benders absolutely hate benders.
Yeah.
Because he's rounding them up, putting them into camps, cutting off their power, and just arresting them en masse for peacefully protesting. Timely! Just to, you know, serve a fucking point and just making Amon's point so much stronger and maybe pushing more people to his side.
Yeah.
So and when it was actually revealed, like when he showed up... After Korra like goes to confront Tarlok, and you know we learn that Tarlok is in fact a bloodbender and one of the strongest ones, and you know like beats her, takes her away, and like imprisons her in like a platinum cube, I guess. We see that Amon has come, like, and after he gets like busted for that, Amon shows up at his place. I'm like, oh, here's the reveal where we realize that they've been working together. And then Amon and his people just beat the shit out of him. It's like, oh, okay.
Yeah. And again, so I want to... I also want to talk a little bit more about Amon's past, because I kind of glanced over it. The whole Yakone thing was told...
Yeah, Yakone, who was... Like, basically told in flashbacks to Korra as this gang lord crime boss who was... So strong at bloodbending, like a prodigy, he was able to do it without the power of a full moon, and Aang eventually had to take his bending away.
I think the way that story was told sucked. Like, specifically that part of that story, the way that it was told sucked. Because...
How would you have told it?
I would have definitely started seeding it a little bit earlier, at the very least. Because as the way
they kind of did give it in a little bit of drops, but they did need to kind of give it all at once at some point.
It's kind of maybe hinted at, and then suddenly, oh, here's it all. Korra can now just tap into it, which the progression of the story in the series is definitely rushing that first season, and you can tell that it definitely wanted more episodes just to kind of air that out a little bit. And then we get the story about Yakone, who, when you first see it, you're not sure how it ties back into everything in a significant way. Later, it does, but I don't know. I did not like the way that it was written into the story. But then we find out that Yakone is Tarlok and Noatok's, or Amon's, dad. And that story is interesting to me. I actually really liked that. I mean, besides the fact that they apparently had really, really good plastic surgery back in what was would have essentially been the turn of the century.
Like 1900, basically, in our time.
Yeah. But the idea, like, because everyone's like, oh, Amon just has daddy issues. And I'm like, well, it's a little more than that. In something that I think people need to understand... Well, okay, that comes off as really condescending, and I apologize. But there's a lot of arguments to be made about how fathers affect their sons, about how our parents affect us in general. And what Noatok saw was, no, this is something that can be used to subjugate other people. And if you don't, you know, if you don't stand up against it, if you don't do what's necessary to stop it, you will be one of those people who is used and abused.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why that was such a really interesting moment. Like, I was like, oh, okay, so this all stems from a really personal place. This wasn't just a firebender killed my parents. It was my own father used this against me and made me hate the very thing that makes me strong. And I'm like, wow, that is such a cool fucking story. Oh, man. Wouldn't it have been great to learn more about how he struggled with that and how he grew? But don't.
They did kind of do like what Demon Slayer does. Shout out to the Demon Slayer short we just put out. Go watch that if you haven't. where they just kind of give you all of the exposition for the main antagonists, like, rights, I think both of them kind of in the same episode of the season. Just kind of like, yeah, this is what happened to us. There you go.
Yep.
Isn't that sad?
And
now go fight him.
And that, yeah, and that's the really frustrating thing of that. So fucking the Fire Lord was as two-dimensional as they come, but he was also always supposed to be kind of a force of nature. He was never supposed to be this fully realized deep character. That's why you had Zuko. That's why you had Azula. Like, you had those villains slash, you know, villains turned heroes with real depth and interesting characters. So when you had him on, it's like, hey, you're really trying to give us this super, super interesting character, but you've done it through flashbacks, and you've given us a motivation that you don't actually expand upon. So by the time Amon's to be defeated, you don't really feel much of anything for him, because you've taken away what made him so cool and mysterious and replaced it with a potentially interesting story that's just not developed. So by the time he's defeated, it's like, well, that was Amon, guys. Although I will say, nice boat.
Oh yeah, the ending of their arc, really strong. Although if you do read into Amon like the way you did, like, you know, about like how that psychologically affects, yes, it would have been nice to be able to touch in on that a bit more. But it's interesting to look at that and also see how Tarlok kind of, like, the lessons he took from that as well, after Noatak ran away to go live out his life mission. Tarlok kind of took the opposite message, being like, okay, no, I have this power that I'm able to use that, you know, I can use at a given moment to overpower any enemy I might come up with. But like my father, I need to be sneakier about it. I need to win people over. I need people to trust me. And so he takes like the almost the opposite method of Amon in, you know, trying to work his way up the ladder of the social, like, up the ladder socially in Republic City until he's, you know, one of the lead councilmen of that city.
Yep. So their stories are fascinating. And that's why I think that Tarlok was the more fascinating of those two characters, because you spend so much more time with him and get to understand him. Like, that's why Tarlok is a better villain in the first season than Amon, even if Amon is significantly cooler for like 80% of the time of that, like 80% of that show. Also, yes. The fight between Tarlok and Korra is, oh my god, rewatching that gave me fucking goosebumps. Jesus.
Yeah, with the waterfall in his office, just like putting up a shield, throwing rapid firing like ice bullets at her.
Yep.
It's good shit, man. This show has some awesome action.
And the reveal that he was a bloodbender came out so good. There's so many good scenes in that first season that
First season also introduces one of my favorite characters. Possibly my favorite character of the entire show.
Oh boy, oh, hold on. We haven't said his name yet. Oh wait, no, we haven't said his name yet. Please don't say
it. We have not.
Bolin. Oh my god, of course it's, yeah, Bolin for you.
I love Bolin. Bolin's awesome.
Bolin is a second-rate Sokka who...
He's more than that, though. He really is.
Yeah. Okay.
Look, he has his problems, but I like every scene that Bolin is in. I feel almost every scene that he's in feels like it's slightly elevated by his presence. He's always kind of the third rate character that's there, but his moments are strong, and he is best boy in that show. Come on,
he is fine. Like, he's not Mako. Bolin. Yes, he's not Mako. See, my issue ultimately with Bolin is that when he's introduced, actually, it's the same problem I have with Mako. When they are initially introduced, I was about them 100%. I'm like, okay, so Bolin is this well-meaning guy who really likes the fame that Probending gives him. Meanwhile, Mako is this guy who is focused only on the game and he has no time for any bullshit. And I'm like, okay, cool. I understand who these characters are. And then very quickly, they kind of start to feel like... I feel Bolin becomes less interesting and less, like, more of a doofus, more of an idiot as the show goes on. Because they wanted to give him all these really funny lines, but all he comes off is somebody who is woefully out of his depth. Meanwhile, Zook,
that's because he kind of super is, despite being one of the better earthbenders out there.
Yeah, and I would have really liked if they'd given him if they'd made him a little cooler. He didn't need to be like, oh, I'm the cool guy who always does things right. But he could have been one of those guys who's like, no, I have these really cool skills that I know how to use. And even if I am a little bit silly and stupid, I can kick some ass. But it felt like most of the time he was just kind of like barely getting by and also never contributing anything to conversation. Except for, like, again, he's funny, but very rarely does he actually help with the plot.
I disagree, because to me, I always kind of look at Bolin like, the difference between Bolin and Mako are kind of the difference between Jackie Chan and Jet Li. where Mako is just very serious. I'm going to get this done. I'm hyper focused, you know, being Discount Zuko and all that. And Bolin, on the other hand, is always on the back foot, just looking for something that will give him an edge. And he always manages to find it. It's that interesting dynamic. And I like characters like that, that are basically out of their depth in terms of, like, you know, what they're trying to go with. And yes, he's a bit of a duper. But yeah, he's a big old duper. But he's also not, like, he's not meant to be a smart guy. He's not meant to be a Sokka who is, like, you know, a brilliant strategist.
I definitely didn't need that.
Yeah. He is emotion. Like, he is a soft boy.
He is a soft boy. He's a very soft boy, and that's fine. I'm okay with him being the soft boy. But again, he's so annoying throughout the entire show, because there will be these moments that are, no, it's like, shut up, Bolin, this is serious. Stop saying stupid things during these moments where we need to plan something legitimate. And that's the thing that killed me.
It's unfortunate, though, that you're talking about this on a show that's on Nickelodeon, because there's always going to be, like, there's going to be kind of a need for that on those shows, especially when you got, like, network executives talking in your ear, where it's funny?
So the issue that you find with that is that I'm sorry to make the comparison. I know they're two different shows, but in Avatar, you had a couple of different characters who actually provided the funny. You had Toph. You had Aang, who was, you know, oh, I'm funny in my own, like,
he's lighthearted and goofy.
Yeah, and then you had Sokka. Sokka was more sarcasm and sometimes not stupid, but, like, a little goofy. You had Toph, who was pure sarcasm and just basically
sardonicism.
Yeah, and snark. And then you had Aang, who's light-spirited and happy and a little goofy.
Yeah, what you're saying is, unfortunately, all of these are kind of all wrapped up into Bolin.
Yeah, Bolin has to carry the load on that one. He's like, I have to be the guy who's providing the laughter every time, because Mako's certainly not. Korra can be funny, but only from only sometimes. And Asami? No.
Yeah, Asami, who, watching through the show, again, kind of going into spoilers, I watched it through the lens of, okay, I want to see how Asami and Korra actually kind of start to get along, you know?
Yeah.
Asami is actually a very interesting and far more nuanced character than I gave her credit for originally. Like, she doesn't have, like, the yucks, she doesn't have a whole lot going on, but she plays this role like she's... the comparison I made in my head is she's basically the Bulma of the group if Bulma knew how to fight.
See, Asami was one of those characters that I actually desperately wanted them to develop more. And they do a little bit more in seasons 3 and 4. But man, yes. So in season 1, she gets fucked. And in season 2, it's even worse. I cannot believe how badly the show treats Asami in its first 2 seasons. Because she is a character
Season 2, she's literally only treated as the love triangle character.
And then
Season 1, she's introduced as it, but at least she's shown to be, like, an actual competent martial artist.
Yes, and that's good. I'm very glad that Asami gets to stand on her own. but man, season two fucked her so bad. Like, the fact that it's like, oh, she's back in a relationship with Mako.
Kinda.
Oh, and then no, she's not, because Korra lost her memory and Mako doesn't feel like right now is the right time to mention that they broke up. And then it's never addressed again. You just get a dirty look from Asami, and then she's a non-character for the rest of that season. And it's, holy shit. Like, I couldn't believe how badly Asami got just... season two dicks over every character, though.
Season two is just kind of the worst. It really is. Like, it takes all of the stuff that you, like, were introduced to and actually kind of liked about season one and just kind of makes the characters a bit worse.
Yeah.
Like, it treats Tenzin poorly.
Oh, yeah.
Even though I think season two is kind of where Tenzin develops. No, season three is where he develops the most. But he actually gets a little bit of development in season two. Which, you know, I actually really like J.K. Simmons' Tenzin. Like, he's...
Oh, yeah. No, he's great. He's fantastic.
He's fun.
But Lin in season two is fucking terrible.
She has, like, nothing to do in season two.
Yeah, and she's also an idiot. Season two is where everybody holds the idiot box. Because the only way that, like, Korra, as character, like, literally... Her character is basically...
Her character is don't tell me what to do.
Yeah, and it's like, Korra, you literally just went through a bunch of really serious events that taught you don't act like this, and then she acts like this, and it's like, what the fuck are you doing? Also, the Mako Korra stuff was never at its worst until season two. Like, that was... Oh my god, that was awful. Holy shit.
Yeah.
Like that is the worst. And everyone says, oh, but they're supposed to be a bad couple. Then, stop showing them as a couple all the time. Stop it. Just don't make that a huge fucking point part of the show. Stop making a huge part of Korra's character being her terrible relationship with this dude. It is not fun to watch. It is not entertaining. There is nothing to be drawn from this other than Korra's sort of a total bitch to Mako, and Mako's a wimp.
Yeah, Mako's pretty one note throughout the entire show. Like, I don't think he, like, he might have, like, I think he has, like, a small character arc, but from point A to all the way to the end, he's kind of the same guy.
Yeah, actually,
By the end, he's a cop. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, Mako's character, Mako sucks. Mako sucks from top to bottom, because Mako could have been interesting if they had actually kept with the characterization they did when they first introduced him. Honestly, it would not have been a bad thing if he'd kind of been Zuko 2.0, where if he'd just been like, no, I don't have time for this, you're acting stupid. He needed to be more mean and more of an asshole. Like, if they had really leaned into that angle of, no, I grew up on the streets, this shit sucks, the world sucks, and I'm here, like, this stuff is all I have, and it's the only thing that makes me happy, and I'm here to protect my brother.
Sounds equally shitty, though. I wouldn't want to be around a character like that every season.
Yeah, but at least they could have made him, like, he could have been sardonic, he could have been cynical, he could have had a character outside, he could have had a character! Like, Mako doesn't have a character, and that sucks, but at least a jerkass is somebody that you can develop over time.
Especially because he's, like, his name is a tribute to, like, you know, the fantastic voice actor of the original Iroh.
Yep.
Like, I remember watching the first, like, season, and, like, just all the way through, I'm just like, wow, they're really, like, throwing some, like, shade at Mako here. What the hell?
Yeah. And season two is a travesty top to bottom. So, by the way, for anybody who doesn't know, season two was actually animated by Studio Mir and Studio Pierrot. The first several episodes, I think it's 1-6 and episode 9, are Pierrot, while the rest of them are Studio Mir, the original studio who does basically every other season of the show. And it's a little noticeable. Like, Studio Pierrot does the best that it can. But if you were to compare the episodes, you'd really see the difference in... how the characters stay on model, the quality of the animation, and the compositing. That was one thing that I noticed immediately with season two. That was also very fascinating for me, because I was like, oh wow, this is a Japanese studio and a South Korean studio working together on the same show. And the plot is Unalaq is Tarlok 2.0, and he's so much worse.
He's so bad that in the season 4 episode where they decide to recap everything, he's given the nobody likes you treatment. Like, the entire season is just so weird. Like, it introduces some really interesting concepts, like the entire spiritual side. It gives Jinora some, it gives Jinora and Tenzin some, characterization, some growth.
Oh, yeah, the airbending family benefits the most from season 2. In fact, mm-hmm. by and large, God, I remember watching that season, like, can we please just stick with Tenzin and his family? This is so much more interesting than everything that's going on with Korra and Mako and Bolin, and oh my God.
And it does give us Spirit World Iroh. It does introduce us to the Spirit World, which is admittedly, like, you know, it's admittedly kind of like a cool concept, cool idea that you have, like, this gateway to an entire other realm where, I guess part of the season is just an isekai, but, the concept of literally there being this opposite force to what the Avatar is, I think is what you were referring to when I was talking about Metachlorians. The demystification of what the Avatar is. And it comes in actually my favorite episodes of season 2, which is all the stuff about Avatar Wan, the first Avatar. I think it is the best part of season 2 to me. I really like stuff like that, where it basically gives you a wiki dump and you are grumbling really hard. I'll let you burst into this in a second, but let me just talk about how I liked it.
Go ahead, I want to hear your perspective on this one, buddy.
I'm sure you do. I like that they changed the animation style. I like that they, like, you know, give you this idea of, like, yeah, you know, once the world and the spirit world, like, you know, the human world and the spirit world were, you know, easily accessed by one another, and the only way that men were able to travel out and not get murdered by these massive monstrous spirits was by being gifted the power of the elements. I don't necessarily think that they needed to be lion turtles, but hey, you needed to tie it into the first season somehow. So the lion turtles give the humans the ability to harvest the elements, and that's where, like, you know, Wan, just being this kind of Aladdin-like character, goes out just like, yeah, you know what? I'm not going to live here anymore. I'm just going to go live with the spirits, be one with the world. And I legitimately liked his adventure. I liked the way it played out, even though it was shorter than I might have liked, actually. I think if you had given it more time to pan out, you probably could have delved a bit deeper into some of the themes they were playing with, but it's something that I genuinely enjoyed. I kind of like things like that, especially when you compare it to everything that's surrounding it. Now go ahead and rip me to pieces.
I should note that when I talk passionately about some things, I can come off as really condescending, and I do acknowledge that it is not something that I really like about myself, and I'm really sorry if I ever come off as me acting like I know better than you or I'm right and you're wrong. I really do apologize. That is not something I like to do. I'm sorry.
That said,
I also want to acknowledge that these episodes, the Wan episodes, are gorgeous, like amazingly beautifully animated. Mm-hmm. I
love the art style. It's almost got this kind of watercolor palette to it.
Yeah, this was the first episodes that Studio Mir did in season 2, and I'm really, really glad that these were the episodes that they did, because I don't even want to imagine what would have happened if Pierrot had to have changed their style up this much. And it's not just, like, I love the way the bending looks. It's so cool. And the spirits are all so heavily Miyazaki inspired. And that's fine. I'm really okay with the fact that they just basically ripped off Miyazaki whole hog for all of its spirit designs. That's, they look great. The spirit world looks great. I love the design of Wan. And yeah, you're right. He's kind of this Aladdin character. And that's neat. That's very interesting. The story's awful. It's awful. It's so bad. And not because it's not an interesting story in its own right, but what it does to Avatar is so frustrating for me. It is so... Rava and Vatu are awful.
Yes, I agree. If you got rid of the Rava and Vatu part, I'd be much happier.
I could. I think the rest of it could have worked. Getting bending from the Lion Turtles made bending feel stolen. It made it feel unnatural, and it really makes it feel like there shouldn't be benders. It's like, are you kidding me? You're telling me that bending did not come across naturally. And the idea that the first series gave us of they were taught bending from the dragons, from the Lion Turtle, from the badger moles, etc., isn't exactly true. Like, yeah, now we're led to believe that, oh, they learned how to use it from them, but they gained the ability from the Lion Turtles, which, again, it feels unnatural. It feels like it's changed a major part of what we understand about this universe. And again, it makes the benders feel like they don't belong. I hated that. I was like, oh my God, benders shouldn't exist. They are against the natural order. And then we find out that the Avatar is also against the natural order. He basically came in and fucked with Rava and Vatu while they were having their fight. Which, by the way, Rava and Vatu are designed very intentionally after the Taoist yin and yang. Which, mm-hmm. by the way, that is not how yin and yang work at all. Rava basically like, I am the light, and Vatu being, I am the dark. And it's like, that's...
No, the entire point is the little dots inside of each of them.
Yeah, and it's like, guys, that's not how Taoism works. You've basically just set up God and Satan, and now the Avatar has to literally become Jesus Christ. What are you doing? Why are you changing this? Why are you making this? Vatu is stupid as hell. Sorry, there's no such thing as the darkness. In evil. That's the entire point behind Tao, like the yin and yang. There's no such thing as absolute evil and absolute good. You can't have that. So the idea that, like, yep, like the darkness is going to take over and plunge everything into darkness and oblivion. What the fuck? What is this Kingdom Hearts bullshit? But even Kingdom Hearts still had the fucking wherewithal to be like, oh, actually, no, in the darkness, they're still good. It's not so plain. It's not so simple. And I hated it. I actively was like, this is really gorgeous, but this is also bullshit. Like you've given us Satan in a world that has up till now been a story about how everything is complex. Nothing is so simple and clean. So yeah.
I agree with that. I think the Rava and Vatu stuff is just easily the weakest stuff, and unfortunately something that kind of taints it forevermore. But it's also something that I kind of accepted. It's just like, okay, well, you know, this is, you know, by the way that they were explaining it, which is a problem when you try to over-explain fantasy. You always run into problems.
Yeah. Why do I need to know how the magic's made? Fuck you. That's not what I wanted.
Because the only way that the Avatar can exist is because Rava is the one that is channeling all of the different elements, because no human body can hold all of them at the same time. So it needs to be Rava's spirit within a human body. And then Rava is the one, you know, the spirit that just kind of links all the Avatars. And then it does further damage to Avatar in the climax when finally evil water lord,
Unavatu.
Sure. Korra's uncle has absorbed Rava and, or sorry, what's the other one?
Vatu. He's absorbed Vatu and he beats the living shit out of Korra and then
rips out Rava and literally kills the souls of all the ever Avatars, or at least unlinks them from Rava.
Severs the link.
Korra is now just alone. The new Avatar, like the first of this new line of Avatars. It's just like, why? Why do that?
Yeah.
Why?
And the worst part is, it's like, it's... Okay, so the idea of like, this big tragedy, that's such an interesting idea. It's not even one I, like, ultimately dislike, but... Unalaq does it. I'm sorry, I can't get past the fact that Unalaq, this shitty, terrible villain, and he really is terrible, which is only made worse by the fact that he actually starts out with the possibility of being absolutely one of the best. Mm. But this awful villain with an awful idea ends up ruining a huge part of the lore and shrinks down the story by separating her from her past lives. Now, we don't know if it's forever. Ultimately, I feel like there could definitely be a story.
We kind of do know it's forever by now, though, because nothing ever comes of it. It's done.
I should point out that the Korra comics are still happening.
Whatever.
I mean, who knows? But yeah, that really sucked. I remember watching that. I'm like, this is just sad. I'm not really interested in this now. Like, I felt. Hold on. Oh wow. Okay. So apparently they confirmed that she'll never get that link back. So yeah. That's great. That's fantastic. That actually makes me sad more than anything.
It's what I expected, though. I mean, season two to Avatar is the most cataclysmic thing that ever happens, for good or bad. Because there is some good that comes from it, but my god, is the season just bad. Even its B-plots are, like, super weak. It introduces one of the other best characters of the show, Varric.
Oh, we haven't talked about Varric, and I feel really bad about that.
We have not talked about Varric. He gets introduced this season as, you know, just a mogul, somebody who wants to make money in any way, and he comes across as, like, really shady, and in fact he kind of is, but he still has, like, he means well, but he does bad things for good reasons.
So, oh man, okay, Varric is
okay,
frustrating.
Kaiser, do the thing.
Okay, appreciate. Mm-hmm. Varric is frustrating for me because, actually, the moment he's introduced, I was like, okay, you can go one of two ways, motherfucker. And then he goes heavy in one direction of just being entertaining and funny and enjoyable. But then they did something where, Mako runs into Asami's room to be like, I found out what happened. And then fucking Varric just turns around and grins at him. And I'm like, oh, shit, this is great. Varric villain turn, let's do this.
Yeah, I loved that. I loved the heel turn.
But then nothing really comes of it. Like, he definitely ends up becoming kind of a villain. He tries to fucking steal the president.
He's a puckish rogue.
Yes.
Is what you would say. Like, he's chaotic neutral.
But I was hoping that they were going to drop the puckish rogue part and just have him be like full on like, no, you don't understand how this business works, buddy. Like, he even does that. He even has that moment where he has Mako alone and he's like, I'm just saying, things can happen, man. And then
I was waiting for him to go like full-blown evil and also kind of dreading it because I do think that having him be this like ultimately well-meaning but also extremely selfish and narrow-minded person is good. I think that's a much better character than it going full one way or the other.
I mean, you're not you might be right in that regard. It was something that I wanted and they kind of hinted at. When I didn't get it, I was frustrated. I will say in the later seasons, he does have a lot of really funny moments, and if it weren't for the fact that he is just the telltale like model of the capitalist genius he's a lot like Tony Stark, only he never gets he doesn't properly get humbled until like the fourth season, and there's no real development that leads up to it.
He's Tony Stark if you crossed him with Han Solo, like the kind of like oafishness of Han Solo.
Yeah, and it frustrated me a little bit, like, okay, I guess for all the terrible things you did, you're never actually going to pay for them, so he just kind of gets off really easy. He was a bad guy who did bad things, but because he's comic relief, he just kind of gets to exist and continue doing the things he does until Hitler requires him. Literal Hitler requires him to grow a conscience.
He's specced high in luck and
right.
Intelligence, pretty much.
Which, by the way, we haven't touched on Kuvira.
Well, Kuvira's season 4.
Yeah, it's true.
We still need to talk about the fact that, like, one of the things about season 2 that made it so cataclysmic was the fact that they literally left the spirit world open, which is what they dealt with in season 3. As leaving the spirit world open, all of the airbending started coming back into the world somehow.
I'm
absolutely about it, but after going through this whole line of explaining how this shit happens, and then people just mysteriously start getting airbending, I don't know, you think a couple more waterbenders and firebenders might pop up as well, but I guess that wouldn't make the news. So airbending starts coming back, and it's the first person that you experience it with is one of Aang's children, Bumi, who up to this point was seen as like not being a bender at all. And touching on Aang's children, that came out wrong. I want to talk about the fact that it actually really gave some interesting depth to some of the characters in the original season, because in The Last Airbender, because it starts to paint them as imperfect characters. Like Aang, pretty shitty dad.
Oh my god, yeah, okay. So Aang being a bad dad is such a good fucking like wrinkle for him. It makes sense, like because of how he was raised and what he needed to do for the future. He puts a lot of his time into Tenzin and lets his other kids kind of like
lets them to Katara. Like, he takes Tenzin out on all these amazing, like, you know, training vacations. Like, here, this is like, you know, I'm going to show you everything about the Air Nation, because you're going to need to learn it, because you're like, you're the only child that I had that can airbend. So, yeah. You know, it's up to you to carry this on. So he put all of his attention on Tenzin, taking him out on all these, I guess Tenzin called them like field trips or vacations, out to all these like amazing places where Aang could teach him about airbending, about air nomad society, and none of his other children got that.
Yeah, and it's
while they still love their dad, and he still obviously loved them, it was clear that it was very much a, like, you know, Tenzin is the golden child scenario.
Yeah, and that's, it's, some people say like, oh man, Aang's a horrible dad. No, Aang wasn't a horrible dad. Horrible dads hurt their children intentionally.
Yeah, he was a flawed dad.
Yeah, he was a flawed dad. And the idea that his one of his biggest failings was being like the dad that they all needed, that's really interesting. It's never really indicated that he hurt his children. He just neglected two of them because he was so focused on something that was, to be fair, bigger than all of them. It doesn't excuse it, but it does explain it. And that's why it's so interesting. Like, and that's why I love that foil for him. I love that wrinkle. What a great, interesting idea. That's why when they introduced that in season two, I wanted to spend more time with them. Also, one thing about this show that I want to point out that hurt it, like all top to bottom, the cast in this show is too big.
It is massive. You have like nearly a One Piece size cast in this motherfucker.
Yeah, there are too many characters for as short as this show is, who all have the characters and speaking parts, and there's just, it's really frustrating because you have Tenzin and his family, his direct family, not his wife and his kids. You have his kids. You have Korra, Mako, Bolin, and Asami. Then you have all of the villains. Then you have the supporting cast. Then you have the returning cast. Then you have the people related to the villains. There are so many characters and so little time. It's like, it is so hard to actually focus on developing anyone's story that it's kind of, it's really sad that Lin Beifong gets more development than Mako.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice that she does, though. I like Lin.
Yes, because Lin Beifong is the best character in the show. Don't at me.
She's certainly one of them. We actually get introduced to her family in season three while everybody's out looking for airbenders, because one of the airbenders happens to be Lin's, I guess, half-niece. And it's another interesting wrinkle that you get from these, like, the previous cast. Toph got her fuck on, man. Like, she had multiple partners.
I love the fact that Toph wouldn't settle down.
Yeah. Lin and Su Yin, the Beifong sisters, both have different fathers. Like, I loved that. Because it's not like, you know, they were, you know, sisters and they grew up in the same house, which, you know, they did. But neither of them got to know their father because Toph is just like, I got more important shit to do. I'm making police.
Yeah. And so,
like, you know, she'd go out a night of clubbing. She'd end up with a guy. She'd, you know, use him, abuse him, throw him away, and just...
I mean, we don't know that's how it happened, but she definitely...
One thing she does say is just like, what's to say, your father? I met him once, and, you know, we didn't end up getting along, and he left. That's all it was.
Well, okay, no, what she said was, he was a nice man, but it didn't work out.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't a one-night stand, but it also wasn't something that she was interested in. The guy was probably, for her, too clingy. And that's really interesting to me that she was like, yeah, it didn't work out and I didn't care. But she doesn't really understand that, no, her kids care. And she needed to care about how her kids would feel. And she didn't. And, yeah. And again, it makes sense with a character like Toph. And Toph was a bad...
Toph was a bad mother. Like, yeah. She did not take enough of an interest in either child. She cared about what it was that she was doing and what that represented. And, you know, like the one that's Lynn, who's following the rules, doing everything she needs to make her mother proud, ultimately just kind of is like, yeah, no, you're doing a good job, whatever. And then Su-Yin, who is breaking all the rules, being the rebel, breaking the law, and Toph ends up covering for her. And just says, okay, look, you need to leave the city. Okay, you just need to go. Go stay with, I don't know, your uncle or somebody. I don't fucking know. And she goes out traveling the world, literally joining a circus. You get introduced to Su-Yin. And to touch back in on the point that you made that the cast is too fucking big, her whole fucking family.
Oh my god, yeah. Then we're introduced to the whole Beifong family.
And she's got this beautiful life. Like, she built an entire city. She created an art form out of metal bending, as well as like an amazing defense force. Like, the cities have these like metal flower petals that extend and retract at night to create these domes.
Yeah, she gentrified the fuck out of that place. Holy shit.
She built the place.
Yeah.
Like, the place did not exist until she did. Yeah. She built this city with metal and her fuckboy.
Yeah. Which. And. Oh, man. And then her son, voiced by Todd Haberkorn. Oh, wait. Mm-hmm. Was that? Yeah, that was her son. Oh, my God.
So you get introduced to them, and while all these airbenders are getting recruited, a religious zealot who absolutely adores all things airbending, who also really, really wants to kill Korra and, you know, break the cycle, break the avatar, Zaheer, in my opinion... Well, my favorite, at least, villain in the series gets access to airbending.
Yeah.
And holy shit, Zaheer. Like, yeah. Him and his crew are actually some of the most interesting villains we get, too. Because, like, we actually get moments of levity with them, which we don't get with a lot of the other villains.
Oh my god, right? How amazing is it that there are moments where the villains are just hanging out with the heroes at some points... And it's like, yeah, we're the best villains, but we also have kind of our own thing going on. So
one of my favorite moments was when they're just kind of traveling in the van. I think it was Bolin that they kidnapped.
It was Bolin and Mako.
Yeah,
and Mako's and Mako. Like, would you stop making friends with the people kidnapping us?
And Bolin's just looking at it like, okay, I'm gonna take a guess at you. Do you guys ever just like, you know, make up stories for people? I'm gonna take a guess at you. You were raised by your sister in a very poor upbringing. Your mustache came in when you were 10 years old, and you two have an unspoken romance thing going on. The two characters just kind of look at each other, kind of blush a little. Two out of three, not bad.
Two out of three, like, not bad, kid. I love that moment. See, and that's sort of the frustrating thing about Korra is that I would have loved more moments like that. It was There was only a few scenes where these characters actually get to be characters, and when they are, I actually really enjoyed them. But Zaheer is the only guy who really gets to be a character throughout it. And so Zaheer is voiced by Henry Rollins. He's
effectively the head of a group known as the Red Lotus, which is, you know...
Dumb as hell.
It's a dumb as hell group. Like, their entire thing is, like, anarchy, etc., blah, 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 fuck the establishment. I don't know.
I like the idea of the Red Lotus on paper. But nothing comes of it. It's like, by the way, there's the Red Lotus. And we're going to only exist also, for this one season.
Also, your uncle was a part of it, I guess.
Because we have to tie him back in somehow. It doesn't matter. Look, we're the Red Lotus, and we're here to end the Avatar cycle. And it's like, okay, well, that's sort of an interesting idea. Hey, Zaheer, is your plan dumb as hell? Oh, it is. It's incredibly stupid and poorly planned out. And your idea of anarchy makes no fucking sense. that's cool. At least you're really awesome in your airbending fights and you have neat speeches and you kill the Earth Queen in an amazingly cathartic but ultimately pointless scene. That's neat.
Also, the most graphic death we get in this show. This season has the most graphic deaths we get in this show. They aren't bloody. They aren't, like, on-screen violent. But, oh my god, are they visceral. I also give them credit because Zahir's a kind of short guy dating a very tall girl. And, like, it's...
Oh, yeah, Polly.
Like, it's really cool seeing that as an aspect in one of these shows. It's not, like, a big thing, but it's just, like, a little detail. It's like, oh, that's cute. Look at him. He's, like, 5'7", and she's, like, 6'2".
Hey. Short kings can deserve tall queens.
Hell yeah. Absolutely. And I love the relationship between the four anarchists, the four Red Lotus, the lava bending dude, the girl that like the water bender that literally just makes water whips out into her limbs.
What's her damn name? I feel bad.
I don't know any of their names.
Oh yeah,
I know Zahir.
I knew Pali, Zahir, and Minghua. Minghua. Okay, cool. I was right. Minghua. Is wow, like one of the things that I do love in Avatar The Last Airbender is when they take physical disabilities and then supplant them with bending. She's paraplegic. She has no arms, but that just made her more terrifying. She's just scarier because of it.
Her control over those water whips, like literally being able to like whip them around, turning just the tips into ice so she can get a grip and like moving with them. It's so fucking cool. Like this is easily the best group of villains we get throughout the show. As much as I think Amon is more iconic, Zahir's crew is way cooler.
Yeah, no, Zahir's crew is a fucking they're the anti-gang and they're amazing. But I can't get past, okay, so I love them. They're entertaining. They're cool. But I will say Zahir's plan was dumb as bricks. And
the entire season goes way downhill in the last two episodes.
In the last several episodes, like his whole thing, like there will be no kings and queens. Man's allegiance will only be to himself and the people he loves. And it's like, okay, so by the way,
never how anything works.
Yeah, that's not how anarchy works. Like the idea, the philosophical concept of anarchy, like you have anarcho-communism and anarcho-capitalism, and anarcho-capitalism is more individualistic. Anarcho-communism, though, is what he constantly seems to espouse. But anarcho-communism isn't about like, oh, you're only out for yourself and we basically destroy all forms of government and let everything literally devolve into chaos. Like, and look, I understand if they didn't want to actually involve real true anarchy in there, but like, his idea was literally, I'm just going to fuck everything up and cause way more death in the progress, but now we're not going to have queens and kings. Okay.
The thing is, like, the entire world encyclopedia, governance was always the thing explained the least, because it's the thing that least needed to be expounded upon. At least in this season. It's implied that Republic City is some form of democracy and that the Earth Kingdom is a monarchy, but that's about as far as they go into it. They don't really go into the bureaucracy of it all.
Yeah.
It's very easy just to say, kill all the leaders, let everybody else decide what happens.
Yeah, and it's just that's why it was like, it's a really messy idea, and you don't get a great idea of what Sahir's really all about, because by the end of it, he just kind of seems like a crazy idiot. Like, and
that actually really plays into it, though. Like, he's a zealot. He is bought whole hog into this idea that he has in his head, and now he literally believes, as a sign from God, he is meant to do it because he's been given these earth, like these airbending power that nobody, like that everybody else thought was just gone.
Yeah.
He is whole hog in his beliefs. Like, no, now I know we have to do it. This is a sign from some sort of divine being. We are doing this, and he becomes literally the best airbender we ever see.
Oh yeah, he might be one of the best airbenders that ever lived.
Like, he attains an ability that was only kind of like a legend to airbenders. He attains the ability to fly after one of the most
darkest,
brutal
most brutal,
deaths.
Most metal scenes. Holy shit.
When, I think it's Suyin or Lin
wraps
a metal plate around his girlfriend's head, and she's one of the combustion benders. They can, like, make explosions fire out of her face.
Yeah.
Wraps it around her face, and boom, you just hear a pop.
No, you actually don't hear the
her
pop.
Her head is gone.
You actually don't hear the pop.
My head, I heard the pop.
You hear a metal noise, but it's also very subdued because they did not want to elaborate.
No, they cut away to Zahir's perspective when you hear the tang, which is what I meant when I said pop.
Yeah. And then you see him turn around, and then, like, you see the fucking smoke.
And because of that, he is able to literally let go of all earthly possessions. She was the one thing he had left that he was clinging to in his mortal form, and he is able to fly. Like, it's such a powerful, cool moment, but it's unfortunate from then on, we kind of learn what his plan was, which is,
I'm gonna, you know, give you mercury poisoning and then kill you while you're in the Avatar state. That's it.
Well, I mean, that plan is, like, fascinating.
It makes sense.
What a cool idea.
Force them into the Avatar state by poisoning and then kill them. But, you know, you force them into the Avatar state and now they're the most powerful being on the planet. So good luck.
Yeah. And that's sort of, again, it's frustrating because, again, by the end of it, Zahir's idea of how to fix society is dumb as hell and would obviously not even come close to working, which really ultimately undermines him as being this really cool, interesting villain. The fascinating part about that is when it comes back later, and the look on his face when he realizes how dumb he really was is actually almost makes up for it in a way.
I do like that they don't kill him off, that they allow him to come back next season.
Yeah. Also, I'll say the way that they beat Zahir was...
Eh.
Yeah, okay.
It's one of those things that's never been
this many airbenders here in a long time either. We're going to make a tornado. Okay, what was your plan with the tornado? I mean...
Yeah, it's like, okay. That's the ultimate failing of Zahir is I can remember how literally every other villain is defeated. Even after just having binged through it, like the latter part of last week, I forgot about all the airbenders in the tornado. I literally forgot how he lost.
Yeah, actually, I won't lie. When I was rewatching the fight, I rewatched the fight a little while back before it was back on Netflix, and I was like, "Oh right, I forgot Jinora and the other airbenders had a part to play in winning." That's neat. Oh my god, we forgot about Kai. Kai's a character. Kai exists.
Kai's also kind of cool. I liked him as an introduction, like as the plot device that he played in uncovering what was happening in the Earth Kingdom. I felt like he served his purpose. I think that, like, you know, they don't do literally anything with him in season 4 other than,
yeah, he's one of the better airbenders. Yeah,
she's Jinora's boyfriend, and she's also that's literally all he has in season 4.
It's kind of what he has in season 3 too, like that budding relationship between him and Jinora. But it's all right. I mean, I like that it gives some dynamicism to Bolin and Mako, who grew up in a very similar situation to him. It allows them to kind of flesh out their past a little bit more. But due to Mako being Mako, it gives way more development to Bolin than to the other.
Oh yeah. Due to Mako again being Mako.
Which is weird, because at this point, Mako really could have served from some development with Kai, because Mako by this point had been in Kai's shoes and by now he's literally the top detective in Republic City. So he has literally been where he is and traveled along a path that got him to, you know, being the complete opposite of that.
Yeah,
but they do nothing with it, like next to nothing, other than Kai pulling one over on Mako again and again.
But don't worry, in season 4, he does even less as Prince Wu's bodyguard.
Oh my god.
Yeah. So
one other thing I wanted to touch on in season three, just a little bit, was the fact that we do get introduced to season four's villain ahead of time, which I thought was kind of neat. But the instant they show up, call me Kuvira. It's like they got this from this like upward angle. Like she looks menacing. They may as well have been playing like the violent violin in the background, where it's like, okay, so are you evil?
No, I remember seeing that scene too, and I'm like, why is the camera focused on her? What is happening? I was so confused. I'm like, is this character important? We're on the last episode of the season. What the fuck is going on?
And they do end in a very interesting place that they...
Ending of season three is honestly like, that is full whole hog, a great ending.
I looked at that like them saying, go on, Nickelodeon, I dare you to cancel us. Because by this point in their run, Nickelodeon was already giving them the runaround with time slots and weird release windows. And you know that Nickelodeon, because like, and due to that, they were getting very poor ratings in season three.
Nickelodeon fucked over Korra hard. Nickelodeon really shit all over Korra. Like, as much as I have shit over Korra in this talk cast, I know that part of the problem was Nickelodeon treated this show like shit, and I am not gonna let Nickelodeon off the hook for that. Nickelodeon fucked this show over in a lot of ways, and I think a lot of the problems that we saw wouldn't have existed if they'd given them the time and the money to make the show that they wanted to make.
And they fucked over season four even more. But season three was getting hit not only because of the negative reception of season two, but because of that reception, Nickelodeon was like, I don't know, maybe we'll shift it here. We'll move it only to Nicktoons or something. And it just like...
They moved it to Nicktoons. Then they moved it online only.
Yeah. Season four, I think like the last few episodes were only online for a while until they aired it at some point. But... And that's a damn shame, because I think like while season four does not measure up to season one and three, I still think it is far above season two in quality.
Oh yeah, no, it's not even a comparison. By the way, I want to say this before I forget. There was something that I wanted to bring up from season two, but I didn't because we were moving. But I gotta say this real quick. Mm-hmm. I really, 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 really would have loved Unalaq if they had done what they were kind of hinting at the very beginning. I actually would have loved if the series had been about like, no, you don't understand. The world's going to hell. We need to connect back to the spirits. We need to fix this stuff. You guys don't understand what happened with that 100-year war. We're in a bad place. And if we don't start reconnecting, the world's going to be in danger.
If they had played more with that idea instead of him just being like, no, I want all the power. Give me the darkness.
Yeah, where at the very fucking end, it's like, now I want to be the dark avatar and lead the world into darkness. No. That's dumb. That's like worse than the Fire Lord in terms of like low bars of villainy.
Imagine if they didn't touch on Rava and Vatu and just like never brought them up, but he wanted her to open up the spirit portal so that he could like, I don't know, find a way to commune with that energy and almost learn like a form of the Avatar's spirit bending nature. Like if he started to be able to kind of like channel that power and still kind of fulfilling that anti-Avatar like niche, but doing it in a much more interesting, less direct way.
Yeah.
Where he just kind of starts to be able to, you know, commune with these spirits, use them to his advantage, and Korra has to find a way to, you know, restore balance where he is tilting it in a completely opposite direction. That would have been much more interesting.
And she wouldn't even have to have killed him at that point. Like, he could have
trapped him in the, like, mist of lost souls or something.
Or just, like, shown him that he was wrong and how to fix things. And, they desperately wanted the good versus evil battle. And also that stupid kaiju fight that we can all agree. I literally don't know anybody who likes that fucking kaiju fight. I've never met a single person who was like, oh, that was such a cool fight at the end. If you're one of those people, I respect you. I really do. But...
The kaiju fight made very little sense other than being kind of a visual spectacle. like you know, for those that like kaiju, having two giant things fighting in front of a city, kind of cool. Whatever. I mean, it, you know, like been... I do not despise anybody that does like that.
Yeah, I just have not met anybody, which, you know, that's basically me just, you know, saying, oh, well, since nobody likes it, I'm obviously right. I'm sorry. That's not right. That is a fucking, what do you call it?
You're too apologetic. Hold on to your opinions.
Hey, I think that fight was dumb, and you're dumb for liking it. That's what you wanted, right?
That went too far.
Damn it, I'm out of balance. I'm a Korra villain. Oh, no. By the way, the out of balance stuff was so stupid.
Yeah, and that played like season four. Luckily, kind of like does away with a lot of these. Like, it still touches on the spirit world stuff and like the spirit shit that's happening, but it focuses more on the world politics in a more interesting way. Like in an actual sort of like world conquering, like these people are like pseudo Nazi kind of way. Because we end season three with Korra literally just being anemic in a wheelchair, unable to do anything.
Yep.
And there's a time skip where we kind of brush past all that recovery bullshit.
Well, we do initially, but...
Kind of. Like, she's still feeling it. Like, she's still not at 100% her A game. We find Korra, and she's literally in these Earth Kingdom pit fights, just trying to get back into the swing of things, and she's getting the shit kicked out of her by these, like, you know, basic bitch earthbenders. And, like, you know, she's haunted by all of her past trauma, which I think is the most interesting part of season four.
Season four might have just been, like, book four, PTSD.
Yeah, it's literally Korra dealing with PTSD. And we get some fun development from that. Mako finally relegated to a situation that best suits him, a B character in a comedy plotline.
Oh.
It's the best Mako gets, everybody. It's the best Mako gets as the foil to a goofy heir to an Earth throne. Who gets way more development than Mako ever does?
That poor son of a bitch. I know
he's saddled with Mako.
Oh man, I feel so bad because again, Mako could have been a character if he had a character. Oh, but
Prince
yeah.
Wu, honestly, like he starts off, and he's meant to start off as just being the absolute fucking worst. He is the John Ralphio of Korra.
I was literally going to say I was so surprised he wasn't played by Ben Schwartz.
I think that was a little bit before that time.
Yeah. But yeah, it's really too bad.
Like, he's like up his own ass with his own importance. He's like way too out there, way, way, way too goofy and stupid. But as the season goes on, I'm just going to start with Prince Wu so we don't have to talk about him anymore. Yeah. He does like his idiocy does get a little bit more charming and endearing as time goes on, and as he starts to realize, okay, you know what, maybe this is more important than that, maybe I should focus on this, and he actually develops into a semi-decent diplomat.
Yeah,
ultimately abolishing like the monarchy, saying like, no, we're just gonna have elected officials, kind of like what you guys have here. This seems to work cool, and I'm rich anyway, so maybe I'll do something. Maybe I won't.
You know, but Prince Wu.
It's a very interesting political message that they're playing with him, because he's literally an appointed king. Everybody, like when we hear the council talk, it's like, look, like he's not going to be doing anything. He's just going to be kind of ineffective as somebody in governance. We're just going to surround him by the real decision makers. Which is some real world, holy shit kind of messaging that you're throwing out there.
Yeah.
From the good guys, by the way.
Yeah. I would also like to point out...
I thought that was really interesting.
I love Avatar The Last Airbender, but it is very obvious that they don't understand how political systems work, or if they do, they had no, they did not know how to write them into the story.
He has a George Lucas understanding of them.
Yeah, and there's a lot of things that are said in these four seasons about their understanding of the of political systems and economies, etc. And they're not great. The things that they have to say aren't great. Because I don't want to get too far into that, but I really don't like the fact that they're all, oh, hey, so by the way, we had him on, but don't worry, everything's equal now that we elected a non-bender as president, right? Because, you know, once you elect somebody from a minority, then that means that all the bigotry against them is no longer a problem in the system, correct?
See, I think that's ultimately the problem with the fact that this show is... I mean, it has to simplify politics. Yeah. It has to.
But that's why I'm like, don't, like, I really, really wish that shows would stop getting involved in politics if they can't send a good message. Because if the message they're ultimately going to send is bullshit, maybe just avoid it. Maybe you play, like, that's one of the reasons that Avatar was able to get away with the things that it did is like, no, this guy is a monster and a terrible, a terrible dictator, and we have to take him down.
Yeah, that's like a simple story. Story as old as time. Any JRPG can tell that story. If the story can be told in a NES game, that is what you can do in a children's cartoon.
Yeah, and that's why it's like, hey, let's avoid getting too involved in all of this, like, really heavy, really complicated stuff, unless we can send a good message at the end of it. But they failed to do that in every single season, it felt like. Because the only message they could possibly send that was positive was, democracy is good, though. And it's like, cool. Thank you. That's great.
It's, like I said, it's the same kind of shit that, like, George Lucas did with the prequels. But, like, it's ultimately not the point is kind of what I'm getting at. It is, I agree with you that if you're going to put any sort of spotlight on it, sure, maybe focus a little bit more on the nuance. I would argue that they kind of, like, what I was saying when they were talking about appointing the Earth King as, like, you know, we need this guy here because he's literally a puppet.
Yeah.
That is a level of nuance that I don't expect in a children's show. But you are right that the resolution of all of this is always very plain and simple and black and white, but that's unfortunately the nature of the beast that we're working with here in a children's cartoon.
Yeah. And it doesn't help. So Kuvira is fucking Hitler.
She's... Who, by the way, do you know who plays her?
Oh, yeah. Zelda Williams, daughter of Robin Williams.
Yeah. Robin Williams' daughter. Which I did not know when I was looking up trivia. Like, I look up trivia before we do this stuff. That one kind of, like, caught me off guard. I'm like, oh, shit, really? That's cool.
Yeah, no, that was really fascinating. And that was something I ended up hearing about when she hit the... When, like, it's like, huh, who is this? Like, the moment she premiered, I was like, Zelda Williams. Zelda. Oh, that's I didn't know that was a name that women actually had. Robin, what?!
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
She's a somewhat compelling villain in terms of the fact that what she wants to do ultimately is, like, you know, unite the Earth Kingdom, get it all back in one place, build an empire out of it, you know, quote unquote, for the good of the people. But they don't give her enough development to make her motivations make sense.
Yeah.
Because she ultimately wants power. That's what she wants. She wants control. Power. She wants the Earth Kingdom under one mantle, and she wants that mantle in her hands.
Yeah. And for anybody who dissents against her, or is not part of the Earth Nation, she either exports them or you know, kicks them out of the country or puts them in literal camps. Or
six a Gundam on them.
Or six a fucking... The world's ugliest Gundam.
Oh, the Zaku.
Oh my god, what an ugly fucking... Oh god, like...
By the way, technology made a huge jump this season.
Yeah, By the way, there's one part of season four that I want to talk about a little bit that was actually really super fascinating when it was happening, and I think was one of the more interesting parallels that they made. So, you know, I've already said that Kuvira is Hitler. The spirit vines are the atomic bomb. And yes, I thought that
yeah,
was...
That's very... They're very blatant on that when...
I've met some people that disagree that that was obvious. I've met people who vehemently believe that, no, that's not supposed to be the atomic bomb. Hell, Gon argued with me. It's like, that's not what that is. And I'm like, are you kidding me? It's obviously supposed to be.
I don't know why I didn't invite Gon, like, to talk to Gon to ask if he wanted to be a part of this. He loves Avatar.
I know,
right? I would love to hear his take on this, because he's busy literally making Varric, games. Varric has his I am become Death Destroyer of Worlds moment when the cannon fires off from the first time. Like, when he weaponizes, like, when he accidentally weaponizes the spirit vines, he's like, that's not what these were supposed to be meant for. These were supposed to be a source of energy for, like, the people. But put it in the hands of a powerful military, it's like, no, these are an amazing force of destructive power.
And
you have the mayor, president of Republic City, who's like, okay, we need some of that spirit vine technology here as well. We need to fight fire with fire. And Varric's like, no, I'm not doing that shit again. I thought it was a bad idea to begin with. I'm not giving two people that ability.
Yeah, Varric has that moment where even the story realizes they rushed his development. For some reason, lately, I've just been having these thoughts about what's right and what's wrong and wanting to do the right thing, Julie.
Yeah,
that's your confidence, sir.
Conscience, sir. Even in the beginning of the season, he's still kind of a jackass jerk off to Julie. But by the end, I guess I understand the attraction. But I don't understand why she would instantly forgive him for literally all the immense amounts of bullshit that he puts her through and just be like, yeah, no, we'll get married.
Oh, yeah, no, that's dumb and stupid.
That never made sense to me at all. Like, yeah. You know what? Different strokes for different folks. If it works for them, it works for them. If you have a relationship like that and it's perfectly lovely and healthy, congratulations. I don't understand.
Yeah, at least, at the very least, she says, no, we're partners now. But it's like, okay, but girl, you've been spending all this time literally being his, like, fucking just trash to him. She's treated you like shit. How are you just going to put up with this? And I guess it's just, nope, that's their weird, quirky relationship. And at the very end, she says, hey, fucking treat me like equals. And then he does. And then they get married. Okay.
She's a rushed, like, weaker, quieter version of Pepper Potts.
Yeah. Although apparently... Go ahead. I'm really sad that she never fought anybody. Because it is implied that she is a fucking, like, beast. And
like
I would have
that she's like mercy for Lex Luthor.
Yeah, I would have loved to have watched her actually lay out some dudes. Like he kept implying it, but we never see it happen, and that made me sad.
That would have been cool. I agree. Maybe the Korra comics did something. I don't know. I'm never gonna read them.
No, much like the Avatar comics, the Korra comics only make things worse.
Unfortunate.
Yeah, because guess what? Guess what the Korra comics do, by the way?
Oh god, what?
It forgives Kuvira. Like, the show already... is like, oh hey, you know this woman who's literally been killing people and putting them in camps? Yeah, by the way, we're gonna just... Like, she's not gonna serve any time in prison. She's gonna serve... house arrest at Su Yin's place. So basically, she gets off fucking scot-free.
She's probably one of the top three strongest earth. Well, actually, she's probably the second strongest earthbender in the world.
Yeah,
because she fights Su Yin and Lin to a standstill on her own. She beats the Avatar in one-on-one combat. The only one that's probably stronger is Toph, who is easily the standout of season 4 to me. Like, I don't know about you.
Toph,
yeah.
See, Toph was this close to being, like, interesting and good, but then she has one of the dumbest scenes in all of Korra.
Which one?
The one where she talks about the villains. Because I get what they were doing. Like... Oh, hey, so, yeah. Like, one of the overarching themes of Korra is when you're out of balance, you do the wrong thing. If you're too much, like, with... Like, she says, Amon wanted equality. Unalaq wanted to bring back the spirits. Zaheer wanted freedom. And what does Kuvira want? Strength for her nation. But the problem is that that's all bullshit. All of it's bullshit. Unalaq didn't want to bring back the spirits. Unalaq wanted to rule the world as the Dark Avatar. Amon maybe wanted equality, but at the same time, it's so up in the air, and the story that's such a bad idea of, like, presenting whether or not he was actually believed in what he said, that at the very end, like, we had to have Toph explain it, and Zaheer was a fucking moron. He didn't go too extreme, he just didn't know what he was doing.
He was a zealot. I know what they were trying to do there. And I think they succeeded in what they were trying to do, at least for me. While, yes, there is more to what she was saying for those villains, ultimately, she was kind of, like, correct in pointing out that these guys, like, these were all kind of reflections in desires that Korra had as well. Everything that, like, she did was also kind of, like, slightly in service of what the bad guys were doing. She was just not going as hard. She needed to find, like, she needed to be the counterbalance to their, like, radical, their radicalized ideals.
Yeah, well, the idea that the Avatar brings balance, which, by the way, is something that self-appointed by the Avatar after the Avatar fucked shit up. Like, this whole, like, the Avatar is supposed to bring balance thing kind of comes off as insincere, or at least sort of flawed, when it was a human being that caused the problem in the first place. God damn it.
Very much so. And that's something that Toph points out. Like, one of my favorite things that she actually says is, like when Korra's like, the world needs me, and Toph's like, no, it doesn't. The world right. will get on just fine without you. It'll like, the sun will rise, it'll set, the world doesn't give a shit that you're here. You know, sure, you might do some good here and there, but the world keeps spinning no matter what. If you die, like, because think about it. The Avatar dies, and for at least, like, you know, 13 or so years, at least, you don't have an active Avatar.
Nope.
You have one that is learning, like, and is, like, just a baby Avatar that can't do shit to help the world, really. So, in those 13 years, nothing's ever been that cataclysmic. The worst that's ever happened is Aang getting frozen in ice and the Fire Nation just wiping out a bunch of shit, but still, life went on.
Yep.
The Avatar, what Toph said is true. The Avatar isn't necessary. And it's something that the show actually kind of points out super hard in season 2. The Avatar is literally a freak of nature.
Yep. It's frustrating.
And while for a lot of people that breaks the mysticism, that breaks the ideals, I can look at it with, like, kind of a cynical eye, because you can read it just for what Toph says. It's like, oh, come on, it's fine. The world will get along without you. It's got along without you before. It'll get along without you afterwards. You can still make a difference, but, you know, what difference you make is up to you. Or you can look at it through kind of the cynical eye that I look at it with, is like, yeah, no, doesn't really matter. Like, the sun will rise, sun will set, the world will move on with or without the Avatar. It'll deal with cataclysms. That's what humanity does. It deals with tragedy and moves past it.
Yeah.
And I thought that was kind of interesting. And it also, you know, led into Toph's past, where it's like, yeah, she's a shitty mom, but she also still cares about her family. The reason she went to that swamp was to stay connected to the world and just keep tabs on everything that was going on. But essentially, she became Yoda.
Yeah.
Grumpy Yoda.
Grumpy Yoda.
And she's a highlight of this season, because it starts off with a big time skip, and a bunch of the people are working for the Nazis. Like, Bolin is working for the Nazis.
Yeah.
Varric working for the Nazis. I'm sorry, Kuvira's TM, Nazis. you have like the Earth, like you have the Earth King or the Earth Kingdom, which is ready for its next coronation after everybody, you know, everything got back to normal. Kuvira literally swept across the lands with an iron fist, uniting the land against the barbarians that were taking over after Zaheer, I guess, made anarchy and nobody else wanted to establish order. And the big conflict there was that it wasn't supposed to be Kuvira that was doing it. It was supposed to be Su Yin for some reason. I guess because she was like the biggest of the noble families in the Earth Kingdom that had a functioning stronghold.
Yeah, Kuvira was like, yo, you need to step up. And fucking Su Yin's like, no, that's not our purpose. That's not what we should do. And
yeah, she wanted to hide away in her little metal shells, and Kuvira's like, man, fuck that. I'm gonna do this myself. And I guess in the process of doing that, she decided, you know what? I'm good at this. I like this. Everything seems peaceful after I leave. You know, you gotta be a little tough with them, but I think I'm good for this place, and I deserve to keep it. So I think that's the mentality that happened, but they never go into it.
Well, and yeah, they never spent any time actually developing Kuvira until the very fucking end, where we're supposed to have this heart-to-heart moment where Korra's like, I understand, we're not so different, you and I. And it's like, Korra, no. Don't, like, look, I understand that you're really hot-headed and that you've made a lot of mistakes in the past thinking, oh, I need to do this, and then rushing in and then making mistakes. This woman was putting people in camps. You don't get to go, oh, you just wanted what was best for your people because your mommy and daddy left you alone. Shut the fuck up, Sho. That's stupid.
At the same time, I'm going to play devil's advocate again here with you.
Kid Sho, I know, but...
No, I'm not even saying kid Sho. I'm saying that like dark reflection of Korra, which is played out again and again and was pointed out very specifically by Toph, is something that Korra recognizes. Because one thing that Korra had a lack of ever since her first encounter with Amon, when he like literally had her at his mercy, like she's been dealing with this PTSD, she has lacked control. And that is something that Kuvira covets. So she sees Kuvira as this like reflection of like, look, like I don't want to feel powerless in this world. I am tired of being taken advantage of by these people that reign over me. And Korra, after like, you know, Toph's words of like, you know, all these people, like, you know, you're seeking kind of the same thing, just in a different way, realizes and gives Kuvira the we're not so different, you and I speech that pretty much every other villain gave her. Which I think it's kind of neat, but ultimately, it just doesn't fire off the way it should.
Yeah, and part of that is just the Sho wants to make this message. It wants to say these things, and it doesn't set any of them up well. Like, I understand what the messages of this Sho are. I get them. They're kind of laid out. They're sort of said blatantly. They just don't, and again, I gotta say this is my opinion, my perspective. When I say they don't work, obviously I mean from my opinion.
Yeah.
But they don't work for me. They all just come off as ham-handed and not earned or set up very well. Because again, this moment where Korra is trying to identify with Kuvira, like, Korra spent the first two seasons being a total ass brat. It wasn't until season 3 and 4 that she is brutalized, by the way. I don't think we talked about it on the Sho. This Sho really hurts her in horrible ways. Just to knock her down a peg, and it's hard to watch. And sometimes it feels unnecessary to go through this sort of amount of pain and anguish just to teach her this lesson. I don't know. There's a lot going on there.
They definitely go over the top in a lot of ways. At some points in each of the seasons, she always hits a new low. In each of the seasons. Sometimes it's near the beginning. In season 3, it's at the very end. In season 2, it's kind of in the middle. And in season 1, it's after her moment when... like it all starts. Every single piece of this humbling starts when she is literally at Amon's mercy, and he's like, I'm not gonna do this to you now. I'm gonna let this simmer, because when I do this, I want to do it publicly, and the like it's going to be something that shakes the whole world. And there's I think it's very important in that moment that Korra is actually a woman, like a girl.
I mean, yeah, the imagery and the visuals are
yeah. It's very implicative of some very horrific things that can scar people for a very long time. And you might never get past that sort of feeling of helplessness and powerlessness, even though you are, even if you are the most powerful person in the world.
Yeah, it felt very intentional that that was the sort of visual and implication that was going on there.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I think maybe a little out of depth for this show, if I'm going to be completely honest with you.
I think it was veiled enough that the younger audience can say that's a spooky moment, but the older audience, like you or I, could look at it and say, holy shit.
Yeah.
So I think it's very effective because of that.
Yeah. But again, ultimately, at the end of the day for me, there were all these wonderful, like, there were all these messages, all these ideas, expressed visually, expressed through the dialogue, but because the story was so poorly told, never worked because they couldn't make this overarching narrative, and the time that they had to make these condensed, personalized, segregated narratives, they couldn't do it. They couldn't tell these whole stories in these 13 episodes each with as many characters as they had, with as many turning cogs as they had, with no story in all of Korra resonates the way I feel like they want it to. And that's why by the end of it, all I could look at it at Korra was a beautifully animated, passionate mess of a show.
And that's you hit the nail on the head there. That's the biggest, like, that's the biggest division between Korra and The Last Airbender, is the fact that each of the seasons needed to end somewhere where the show could just end. And that hurt it in such a way that you can't tell this overarching story, this overarching grand adventure where you can expand on themes as you go. Because you never know when your last season was going to be, because Nickelodeon was being a really shitty company about all this.
Yeah. Also, the serialized nature of the stories that they were trying to tell, that is a huge difference between Avatar and Korra. Avatar was episodic, but with a serialized underpinning. Like, there was an overarching story that led them throughout these more singular stories.
Grandiose adventures. Yeah. Like,
whereas
it could be more Monster of the Week while just kind of giving you little movements towards the end goal. And Korra, meanwhile, had to have like plot beat, plot beat, plot beat, plot beat, because it needed to fit all of this into 13 episodes every season.
Yeah, it was one of the only reasons, one of the only ways that we're going to be able to tell all of these stories. And I actually think that sort of worked against it. I think it was kind of difficult to get a real, like, to really develop the characters when everything needed to be in service of the overall plot, like everything. So you didn't get a lot of these little moments with characters to develop them, or the concepts, like the overall message of the show. And that's why by the end of it, I don't know, it's tough. It's tough because I remember when I was watching Korra, I was so excited for the show, and I was, hell, all the way to the end, I still really enjoyed it through my first watch. But unlike with Avatar, I've watched all of Avatar The Last Airbender, which is a lot of episodes. I've watched all of it 3 times. I've watched Korra 3 times. Avatar only got better for me as I rewatched it. Korra only got worse. And that's frustrating. Like, because I thought if I rewatched Korra, I'd be able to see it as this cohesive thing. I could really start to connect the stuff that maybe I missed that first time. But no. No, in fact, I actively started to notice things that bothered me more. And that's frustrating.
My opinion is similar. Obviously, Avatar The Last Airbender is a far, far superior show on the whole. Like, it is just great. I will probably watch that series through at least another 3 times in my lifetime if I'm given the chance. Korra, on the other hand, like, it is inferior in a lot of ways. like I said, it's a series of peaks and valleys where the peaks can get pretty damn high. Like, there are some awesome moments that I love in Korra, but the valleys can get so, so low.
Yeah.
Like, the great divide is nothing on the valley that this show can have.
Oh, God. Great. Fucking season two is a season-long great divide.
Pun super intended, BT Dubs. But what surprised me, and going into it, I did not expect this, I actually enjoyed Korra more the second time I watched it.
Okay.
And this is the second time that I've been through it, because I was able to notice a lot of these other themes that I hadn't picked up on before. Kind of like put two and two together, and while overarching, like as an overarching full cohesive unit, it will never, ever compare to The Last Airbender, unfortunately. I still think it has a lot to its merit, and I think it is very, I think it stands alone pretty damn well, as maybe not something that's in that super S tier that Avatar's in, but I might throw it somewhere in the A or B tier. Still, in terms of like children's cartoons that I've enjoyed.
And yes, by the way, thank you all for sitting here for 2 hours while a couple of white guys in their 30s talk about children's cartoons. You're the real MVPs.
We've gone super over on this one, but I feel like we had a lot to talk about.
I was not going to settle for any less, if I'm going to be real honest.
I felt it. So I kept it going, and you know what? Bless the lot of you for sticking with us. I guess the next time we'll be talking about Avatar will probably be when we get more information on the live action show, if that's still happening, which I suppose it is.
Possibly, but yeah.
Can't finish this without talking about the ending, which when I first saw it, super fucking out of nowhere to me, the whole Kurosami thing. I also... For some reason, when I first saw it on television, I distinctly remember them leaning in for a kiss. But when I saw it on Netflix, no, they just kind of stand there looking at each other and they fade out.
That is how it happened in the original, I assure you.
Okay, I believe that, but I guess that's just my Mandela effect going off. I was like, I could have sworn they leaned in. Like, they didn't show the kiss. I definitely remember they didn't show the kiss. But I could have sworn they leaned in or got closer together.
There's actually a version online where somebody made an edit like that.
I recall that.
Yeah. So, okay. From my perspective...
What's your opinion on Kurosami? Because, like I said, I watched through Korra this time through the lens of, okay, I want to see their relationship develop. And I noticed little things here and there, like the fact that they talked about the fact that they communicated while she was in exile, and a couple of blushing glances here and there.
I like your hair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like little moments that actually plays off as legitimate bonding, but nothing that played out quite this, like, it never gave... to me, many romantic implications. There was definitely, like, subtext. But it's still... After rewatching it, even through that lens, I'm like, yeah, you know what? That ending still kind of feels out of nowhere. Hey, your dad just died? Wanna go on a fuck party with me to the spirit world? Is not okay. What I expect.
Let me say this outright. That ending sucks. It sucks. Mostly because the entire thing is a raison d'etre. Oh wait, no, not a raison d'etre. I'm always mix it up with raison d'etre, even though raison d'etre is a completely different phrase.
It's
the falling action. All that second part is like that whole denouement. It's okay. Nothing but denouement, and there's at the very end of it, nothing interesting happens. Nothing grandiose is said. No, like Varric's wedding is the framing device for the ending, and it's like, oh, I guess it's over. Like
we don't get to say goodbye to half the characters.
I mean, we do.
It's so fucking rushed.
We get to say goodbye to the main characters. We get to say goodbye to Bolin and Mako, and Tenzin. But
kind of.
But no, we get a moment with Tenzin. We do. Like, we get a moment with all of them. They're just lame moments. Like, yeah.
They're underwhelming. Everything about the ending is underwhelming.
Yeah, it's underwhelming. There's nothing, like, so by the end of it, she sits down with Asami, and let me say this. So, this was revolutionary at the time.
Yeah, it was a big deal.
Yeah, because like, a lot of Avatar fans, as they were watching through, started to say, fuck it, just have Korra and Asami get together. They both share the fact that Mako was Mako, and they broke up with them, and they've bonded so much, why don't they just become a couple? And it seemed like Bryke picked up on that somewhere at the beginning, either the beginning of season 3 or ending of season 2, because it starts to kind of lean that way as season 3 and 4 progress. So by the end of it, the idea of them getting together was already on the minds of a lot of people in the fandom. But it was also one of these things where it's like, yeah, we'd love to see them get, you know, become closer and become a couple. So the ending is, oh yeah, by the way, the big reveal of the ending is that they're now a couple.
And yeah, they had a background. I mean, maybe they hadn't even, like, you know, really discussed the fact that they were thinking about being in a relationship together, because, like, it's implied that there's obviously an attraction there.
Yeah.
That they have a very close-knit bond, but all of that was in the background. Like, all the information is very, like, subtext.
Yep. And when I was watching it, though, let me tell you, when I was watching it, as a person who grew up without a single gay character in his kids' shows, without even with only the inclination, literally either being characters who are a joke or villains. And finally, for the first moment in his entire life, seeing the implication that these characters of the same sex might end up together. No, you better bet that when it happened, I made a noise that made Christopher check on me. I was psyched. I was so happy. I couldn't believe it. Like, Korra and Asami got together. Holy shit, that's what we all wanted. That's what all the people who wanted, first of all, some representation wanted, and also people who kind of thought, yeah, no, they're just a good, they match, they would work well together. They're opposites attract, and they've already shown that they can be friends. Why not make them a couple? Yeah, no, they make sense as a couple. So when they did it, even though there wasn't enough build-up, even though they didn't develop it, even though it was so subtle and arguable, so arguable that the creators had to come out afterwards and say, no, they gay. The fact that it happened, it meant the world to me and other fans. And
do you think it opened the door for things like Steven Universe to have, like,
wholeheartedly. I 100% believe that Korra walked so other shows could run. I think the fact that they made it happen helped other shows. And some people, and look, I already said the ending sucks. Okay, the ending does suck. It is underwhelming, and the whole romance angle is rushed. I'm not going to argue that point with you, okay? But it was important for us. It was important and interesting. And in a show that was already heavily flawed, you know what? I'm just going to take this as a fucking win. I'm sorry, I am.
Hey, so, no, absolutely. I think it was, for media, I think that moment was very important. Like, they were able to do it in a way that they were able to, you know, get it past anybody that might say, oh, no, two lady kiss bad. In a way that, like, you can still say, yeah, no, they're gay or bi or whatever. It doesn't matter. It's two women in a relationship together. That's the point.
Yeah.
They are together, and that is what matters. So now you can have more shows that are open about that because people are like, yay, go inclusivity. All for that. So now you can have shows like Owl House that do it more openly in, like, a children's television setting. She-Ra, Steven Universe.
Cheapo.
There are probably, like, a billion different shows out there now that are really playing for that.
You know, it's really funny. The one romance that they barely develop at all was still healthier and less annoying than the ones they did.
Yes. Yes.
Oh.
Very much so.
But yeah.
So, yeah, in that regard, while it's still very much out of nowhere, like, if you don't read into the subtext, even if you do read into the subtext, it's still kind of like a, okay, that I didn't see that coming necessarily. But I can't blame Korra. Girls got good taste. Asami definitely top tier.
Oh, yeah. And I should note that them getting together at the very end like that isn't even necessarily bad. It was really just the fact that that's kind of all that ending was. That's the real big problem.
That's all you get. Like, the big thing is, like, the reason she decides to go is, like, I mean, first it's Korra, and they've obviously developed a bond, obviously enough to be considered romantic together. But she literally went through, like, the biggest arc that she goes through in the entire show, which is the forgiveness arc with her father, who, I mean, is basically just Hayao Miyazaki, I guess.
Oh yeah, right. That was very intentional.
That's just what he looks like. She finally gets like a forgiveness arc with him, because one thing we didn't touch on in season one, Asami's dad was working with Amon because he doesn't like benders.
Yep.
And so Asami finally, you know, meets up with him. It's like, okay, like, you know, Kuvira's attacking with her Jaeger, and we need as many geniuses as we can to try to deal with that. And he sacrifices himself to make sure that everybody else can take this thing down, which I cannot overstate how stupid the fucking Jaeger is. I mean, it's an interesting set piece, but where the fuck did it come from?
Yeah, no, that giant robot sucks. They should never have introduced the robots in that show. God, ah.
Kuvira was so much more interesting when she was just a badass metal bender.
Yeah, she didn't.
But then, yeah, this, it has lots of problems.
Like, yeah,
the show has a climax issue.
Yeah.
So, like, she just went through that arc, and at the wedding, you know, she's still real sad. Her dad's fucking dead. Just died, like, not even 48 hours ago or something. And yep. Korra's like, hey, you want to get out of here? Just go with me on a vacation to the spirit world? It's like, you know what? Yes. And that's just how it ends. Like, they wander off together into the spirit sunset, and, you know, just have a gay old time.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what you end up with.
And you know what? An underwhelming ending doesn't always have to be. Like, honestly, if the journey really is that good and the ending just kind of fizzles out, that's not so bad. I think one of the bigger issues is, you know, that journey, though.
Peaks and valleys. By the end, you're kind of exhausted.
Yeah. And as I said, them going off to the fucking spirit world to have a fucking vacation wasn't the bad part of it. It was just the another underwhelming part of all the other stuff that was underwhelming.
Yeah.
So
that's Korra in a nutshell in our longest episode since, I think, our Star Wars review, which I think was like an hour and a half or something.
Yeah, wow.
So we're... We had a lot to say about the sequel series to Avatar, but what do you think? Let us know if you're watching in the YouTube archives. What are your thoughts on Korra? Everybody in chat, we've been seeing you as you've been going, for those that tune in on Stream 4 Star every Wednesday. And, of course, for those of you listening at home, we greatly appreciate you letting us into your ear holes. And we'll see all of you next time on the TalkCast Pod Show. Later, everybody.
Flameo, hot man.